Good morning, and welcome to the first concurrent session of this year's seminar. Well, for this concurrent session, the topic is insurance fraud. Are we winning, or are the odds stacked against us? Just a bit of housekeeping item before we begin. The aim is to have a 25 to 30 minute presentation followed by questions and answers. I'll be reasonably strict with time because it is a very interesting topic, so hopefully we'll have plenty of time for questions and answers and a good discussion. If I could remind you to fill in the presenter feedback forms, you can find that on the online link. You also note that these sessions are recorded, so when you have questions, if I could get you to stand and speak into the mic over there and state your name and the company which you are from before the questions. So let me introduce the speakers for today. And we have three speakers for this session, Raj, Jacob, and John. Raj Karnai. Raj is a principal of Finity Consulting and head of Finity's CTP practice. A solicitor and a former senior insurance manager, Raj has worked in the insurance industry for more than 20 years. Raj specializes in the management of long-tail claims liabilities, including policy design, benchmarking, performance improvements, and claims leakage. Jacob Mamasil. Jacob is a principal of Finity Consulting and has worked in the general insurance industry for 30 years. Prior to joining Finity, Jacob held several senior strategic and operational roles in a major insurer for over 20 years. A qualified lawyer, at Finity, Jacob heads up the ERM practice and also advises clients on strategy, APRA licensing, regulation, and claims management. And last but not least, we have John Giottani. John is an actuary and consultant at Finity. John has over 6 years of experience in the GI industry and has particular expertise in CTP and medical indemnity insurance. Would you please welcome our three speakers?
Thank you very much. So, we're talking here today about insurance fraud. Are we winning, or are the odds stacked against us? What I'll do is I will lead off with some concepts and terminology with respect to fraud, and I'll talk a little bit about the UK experience where there's been a lot of fraudulent activity in insurance over the last decade or so. John will then take over with some local examples of potential fraud here, and he'll talk specifically about credit hire, as well as compulsory third party in New South Wales. And Jacob will then finish off with some ideas about how to respond to insurance fraud, as well as the role of technology. So, I guess the notion of fraud is something that is probably very hard to discern sometimes. It's hard to sort of pinpoint what we mean by insurance fraud at times. So what we decided to do was try to portray fraud as a bit of a continuum. And what we've got here on this slide is what's often talked about, which is soft fraud. And to the right, we've got hard fraud. So what's the difference between soft and hard fraud? Well, I guess soft fraud is really about exaggerating or embellishing what might otherwise be a legitimate claim. So I might get hit by a car, might put in a compulsory third-party claim, and I might just exaggerate a little bit about my potential or capacity to work or not to work. That is often termed soft fraud. On the other hand, you've got hard fraud. Now, hard fraud is where the injury didn't actually even occur, or the accident may not have actually happened. Such things as staged accidents is an example of that. We've also thought about fraud as either opportunistic or organised. So opportunistic fraud is probably, you know, anyone in this room, mostly honest, law-abiding citizens, deciding that they might sort of push the envelope a little bit in the application for insurance, you know, buying the policy or in fact making a claim. It may be something that you haven't really thought about, but the opportunity presented itself and so you committed fraud. And one example of that is in New South Wales recently, a pregnant woman escaped a jail sentence pretty narrowly. What happened was she got caught by CCTV camera actually engaging in a staged accident, staged collision. Pregnant lady puts herself in this precarious position, by getting hit by another vehicle, all to buy a more expensive, larger car for the family. And this was all aired in court. She narrowly escaped jail, as I said. But, you know, that to me is an example of opportunistic fraud. On the other hand, you've got organised criminal rings, and we've all heard of car birthing organisations. We hear sometimes of bikie gangs and others, tow truck drivers that are actually involved in organised crime, perpetrating insurance fraud. And in the UK, this is one area that they really had to grapple with. Another point that I'd like to mention is actually something that I've noted there, which is claim farming. I don't know if anyone's heard of claim farming. Has anyone in this room been contacted by someone over the phone, a cold call, to say, have you made an insurance claim or have you had a car accident? Okay. Yeah, there's a couple in this room here. I've certainly known of a number of individuals, particularly in New South Wales, who have been contacted, basically cold calling to see if, you know, you've had a car accident, and sometimes your data is then sold, or your details are then sold off to a plaintiff insurance firm or some other firm that might want to make a claim on your behalf. There are other ways to talk about fraud. There's also the notion when you're working in insurance claims, this term leakage is used a lot. And what we're trying to do here is just trying to show that fraud is a very difficult concept to really pin down, because legitimate claims can sometimes tip over into the soft fraud or the hard fraud bucket. Now, you know, if I were to make a personal injury claim, I had my lawyer representing me. If I were to attend a settlement conference, I would expect my lawyer to put my best case forward and to argue very hard on my behalf. And I might want my lawyer to put in a very high initial offer of settlement, you know, a very high ambit claim, expecting that the insurer will do likewise. And that is often seen in the industry as legitimate case building. But what happens when that actually becomes a little bit more and tips over into soft fraud and potentially hard fraud? So what we're trying to say here is that there is no fixed notion. Fraud in itself is a nebulous term, we think, and you've got to see fraud in terms of behavioural aspects, going from sort of legitimate behaviour encroaching into something that is certainly doesn't pass the sniff test. Now, what is the extent of fraud? Again, this is a hard thing to pin down. There hasn't been all that much research, we think, into the area of the extent of insurance fraud. And certainly, we don't think that there's been enough data with respect to how much fraud there is out there in the community. So this graph on the left is quite interesting. This graph actually shows the New South Wales monthly fraud. This is all sorts of fraud, incidents per 100,000 people. And these are based on incidents reported to the New South Wales Police. So here in 1995, you can see that the rate is about 20 per 100,000 people. And if you go across to April 2015, you've got a figure of around 50 per 100,000 people. So I guess we ask the question, what does this mean? Does this mean that the incidence of fraud has actually increased in the community? Or is it the fact that the police is now better at detecting fraud and addressing fraud? And that question hasn't really been answered in our view. And I saw an article in the paper on Friday in Sydney, and this was about fraud within the New South Wales Public Service. And I'll just read it out. It's a very short excerpt. But it says that reports of fraud within the New South Wales Public Service have nearly doubled in the past 3 years. But why is a mystery? More than 1,070 cases worth about $10 million were reported between 2012 and 2015. This compares with 562 cases of fraud between 2009 and 2012 worth more than $7 million. And I think this is the real point. What had driven the surge was unclear, the New South Wales Auditor General said yesterday. And research, don't know what research, but research suggests unreported cases could be nearly triple the reported figures. So again, very hard to pinpoint what the extent of fraud is in the community. Often the figure of 10% is bandied about as the figure that, of all insurance claims, if you ask 10 insurance claims managers, I reckon the majority would say, yeah, about 10% of claims are fraudulent. Where that figure comes from is a bit of a mystery. And if that's the case, it probably costs the industry about $2.2 billion a year. Let's just harp on a bit about this 10% figure. Working in a good actuarial firm, we're quite obsessed with the robustness of numbers. So we had a bit of a debate about what this 10% actually represents. You know, is it based on volume or is it based on cost? We don't really know, but what we do know is that it seems to rely on a 1994 Insurance Council of Australia report, which is, according to the website, no longer available. We don't know the source of the data or how robust the data is. So, you know, if you talk to people in the professional indemnity side of things, they'll probably say that insurance fraud is quite small, and I suspect that would be the case. In the UK, there's figures of about 8 to 9% talked about. However, when you look at how they deal with fraud, what they call the repudiation rate, and I'll talk about that later, it's about 6%. In Canada, there's talk from some of their websites of 15%. What we found interesting was this notion from the Coalition Against Insurance Fraud that 8% of fires globally involve fraud. Now, we tried to dig a bit deeper about this. Is it, you know, bushfires, natural fires? What sort of fires are we talking about here? But 8% seems to be quite a material figure. The percentage of fraud in travel insurance, and we can see the propensity to commit fraud in travel insurance might be high, but some figures we saw, again, very old figures, was around the 20% mark. Now, that is extremely high. So let's just move on to the UK experience, because there's a lot of lessons to be learned from the UK. What's been happening in the UK, particularly in the motor market, it's been largely unprofitable over the last 20-odd years. Motor insurers in 2010 lost about $2 billion. Now, this is really scary. 1 in 7 injury claims were linked to this crash for cash type scam, which is essentially staged accidents. And in 2011, there were about 2,500 claims management companies, which essentially a lot of them were involved in things like claims farming. So the graph on the right is quite interesting, isn't it? So you can see that road accidents are coming down. You'd expect that with technology, etc. Yet the amount of motor claims settled was going up. And in the UK, there's a lot of discussion about this sort of thing, and there's a term there that they call a compensation culture, which they think has really taken hold of the UK and really causing detriment to policyholders and the community generally. So what's been the UK response? In relation to all of that, what the UK has done, they spend quite a bit of money tackling and fighting fraud. As at 2016, in the motor side of things, the insurance industry spent about £200 million per year tackling fraud. And according to the industry, the payoff is about £800 million in repudiated claims. So for every £1 spent tackling fraud, there's a £4 payback, you know, which is a pretty good payback. When you look at the sorts of things that they've done in the last decade or so, they've done quite a bit. Because the problem was that bad. There's been the creation of the Insurance Fraud Bureau that detects or assists in the detection of fraud and the prevention of fraud. It's an industry thing. It also assists in dismantling sophisticated fraud rings. The Jackson Review into Civil Litigation, which was conducted in 2009 and 2010, also ensured that there were some measures made to, like, ban referral fees, for example, to deal with legal costs and fix legal costs in small matters. The other thing that's quite interesting is the Insurance Fraud Enforcement, the IFED, which is a specialist police unit funded by insurers, which essentially investigates insurance fraud. And as at 2015, in the last 3 years, it's had over 200 convictions and almost 300 cautions issued, and it's recovered assets in excess of £1.3 million. They've also had over 700 arrests, and at any given time, there's about £20 to £35 million pounds of fraud under investigation. There's a whole host of other things that the UK has done. If you look at the right here, this is still a proposal, so the government's trying to deal with the issue of general damages and eliminating it for small claims, but that's still a hotly contested issue, and the solicitors are obviously pushing back. Just a quick word on technology. The UK has also done a fair bit in this space, but you know, you've got to ask yourself, some of these exchanges and data sharing has been around since the mid-90s, and yet the problems persisted. And I think that's because some of these have a pretty low take-up rate. So the claims and underwriting exchange really has a very low level of subscribers. The insurance fraud register has about a 40% level of subscription. However, the industry recognises that this is a problem, and they're looking to probably double that in the next few years. One thing that's interesting is that some insurers see this area of fraud as an area of competitive advantage, which is an interesting take. We can understand that. But at the same time, I think this is one area clearly where, you know, a rising tide certainly lifts all boats. Did the reforms in the UK work? Well, from 2011, 2010 to about 2014, it certainly reduced the number of fraudulent claims. They think certainly a reduction in the number of suspicious motor injury claims. There's been some savings in the industry, and there's been a reduction in claims frequency as well of about 10% in 1 year, in 2012-2013. And a big one, the reduction in the number of claims management companies after harsher regulation. Quickly on the ABI fraud data, this is the Association of British Insurers, which covers about 75% of the insurance motor market, and they report on stats in relation to suspected and detected fraud. We can see from their figures, this is what they call the fraud repudiation rate. You can see that the light blue line is the value of fraud repudiated, and the dark blue line is the volume of fraud. So, you know, there's been greater repudiation of fraudulent claims, i.e. insurers have either pushed them, you know, knocked them back, they've either withdrawn the claims, or there's been a significant compromise in the settlement. And that's been going up. The question is, has that been on the basis of insurers actually repudiating more, or is that on the basis of more fraudulent activity? We can see in the last couple of years that's tapered off. Just quickly on what we talked about earlier, a couple of categories of motor fraud, organised versus opportunistic. You can see that the vast majority of fraud perpetrated, or 76% here, is opportunistic, and about one quarter is organised. Although it's quite interesting to see that the in terms of value, the opportunistic claims are of slightly higher value. We've got a bit of a theory about that. I won't harp on this too much, but another interesting statistic is that because of all the heat being applied in the area of motor insurance, what we've seen over the years is there's been a massive increase in the number of hearing loss claims in the UK, and the vast majority of those are actually rejected. And, you know, the government is certainly putting it down and recognising that that's been a bit of a transference into the area of liability, as in employment liability claims. And it's a sign of more inventive and more ambulance chasing. Another interesting statistic here, with hearing loss claims, damages are pretty low. They're only about £3,000 on average, but legal costs on average are about £10,000. So, you know, for lawyers, it's a speculative exercise, and if they win, they can make a pretty good buck. I'll now hand it over to John to talk a little bit more about credit hire.
Thanks, Raj. So as a local example, this is an area, credit hire companies getting involved in servicing not-at-fault claimants in motor accidents, where we've got some concerns about the level, about what's going on and the potential for fraudulent activity. Just really quickly, these are some of the players in the market. They provide a service to the not-at-fault claimant to store the car, to get it repaired, and to provide a hire car so that you're not without wheels while your car's being repaired. There's a lot of growth that's gone on here, and there's a lot of potential for more as people realise they have the right to access these services. But part of the issue and the concern is that where a credit hire company is involved, servicing the not-at-fault claimant, that claim costs are being inflated, and so insurers are starting to see this in motor average claim sizes, potentially doubling third-party claim costs. Potentially the claim is looking at around $8,000 from about $4,000. You can see from the pie chart there's a lot of higher car costs compared to the repair costs in these sort of claims. And estimates are that this where credit hire companies are involved, the costs of those claims are, across Australia, estimated to be around $400 million at the moment. So the inflation of these costs is, I guess, not surprising, because the at-fault insurer, where the credit hire company seeks to recover the costs from, is not involved, and there's not able to exercise controls over the hire car that's provided, etc., and they only are up for the bill down the track. So I guess just laying out the relationships really, really quickly, you've got the not-at-fault driver, the relationship they have with their insurer, and the not-at-fault driver serviced by the tow truck, the company, the credit hire company, and the repairer. And the concern is that there's a lot of connection and relationship between those parties. Potentially, you could have behaviours where, the repairer takes longer to repair the car in order to help a company they're connected with in terms of being able to hire out the car for longer. And they're paying referral fees to send the claimant off to each organisation. And the further potential is that this is where we talk about hard fraud or exaggeration. You might have the incentive for the accident to be induced or staged, where potentially these organisations could pay bribes to people to stage accidents, and developing all this cost, which is all obviously funded by the at-fault insurer and therefore motorists. So there's a concern there. This is a case in the New South Wales local court where credit hire car charges of $124 per day for 87 days were sought to be recovered from the at-fault insurer. The judgment was good and sensible and favourable to the insurer, where only $44 per day for 14 days was required to be paid, acknowledging that the fact that you could get an ordinary hire car, I think it was a Toyota Prius, from an ordinary company, and you don't have to pay $124 a day. And once the car was written off, the judgment was that you don't need a hire car after that. So we're talking only 6% of the cost that was asked for, and it was asked for over $10,000. So, there's obviously significant inflation of costs in this case. Whilst it's not fraud, we're concerned about the potential for fraud and exaggeration to develop in this area. I might leave the UK experience. They've had some similar issues, and as you would expect, the credit hire companies defend themselves by saying, well, we're offering a service to the not-at-fault claimant that the at-fault insurers don't provide them. They could provide them a car if they wanted to. They're not. They argue they're filling a vital gap, and their profits are reasonable. But obviously, the not-at-fault claimant, they could be up for a lot of money if the credit hire company cannot recover the funds from the at-fault insurer. So there's a concern there. Let's move on to New South Wales CTP. So many of you know, aware of the situation in CTP. There's been a huge increase in minor injury legally represented claims. The premiums that are required to meet the cost of those claims has increased by over 120% since 2008. CIRA estimate that 75% of the insurance premiums are a result of fraud and exaggeration. As you can see, there's, just like you saw with the UK experience, you're seeing this conflict between road accidents and road casualties declining, but yet dramatic increases in these low-severity legally represented claims. So what we just want to look at from this, the first angle we want to look at with this is just how data analytics can be used to better detect fraudulent the source of these fraudulent claims, and therefore help insurers and the regulators better respond. Finity was engaged to do some work for the regulator in 2015, and the results of this work are publicly available, the findings, on CIRA's website. But this is just to describe some of the analytical methodologies that can be used. The first, to understand the source and the region of these claim increases. On the left, you've got the geography concentration in southwest Sydney. And then looking at those claims, doing some segmentation so that the machine learning algorithms can find, well, what segments are resulting in large increases in these claims. And it turns out, they're circled in red, it turns out where there's non-earners making claims, where interpreters are required, and where there's a significant number of child claims per vehicle. Then looking at some of those problematic segments, let's go a bit further, and what was done was conducting a network analysis to examine whether there are common providers who might appear suspicious in some of these segments. When we talk about providers, we mean plaintiff law firms, we mean doctors, we mean medical centres, etc. And so what you see here is an output of such analysis. Obviously, providers' names are all blurred out. And what you're looking for here, or rather what this chart shows you, is each dot is a provider, and the linkages between them are where claims link those providers. They've got a claim where they're both providers are on that claim, and above some threshold, the provider and the linkages will show up on this neuron map. And you can particularly see you're looking for the outliers, the ones that where there's strange connections that aren't you don't see a pattern of connection like you do around those spirals in the centre. And so, for example, on the right-hand side of the slide, you've got law firm A and Dr. A. There's about 200 claims that connect them. And if you do some research into those organisations, you can find that that's actually a plausible reason as to... Well, not a plausible reason, but a reason that connects them, which is suspicious. Some of those networks are not necessarily suspicious on further examination, but what we're looking for is possible indications of fraudulent behaviour using such analysis. And so what we did was you take one of those segments, one of those networks, and we look at the characteristics of the claims to see, well, how do they compare to the overall portfolio? So, for example, in that particular network, you've got a much higher proportion of claims per accident made, so potentially claimants claiming where there's not much injury. You've got a higher proportion of children claims and other non-earners, particularly at the expense of pedestrians. Very few pedestrians have any claims of injury. Potentially some of these accidents might be staged. For the children, there's a significant increase in children claims from children that are 0 to 2 years old. You've also got a much higher proportion of psychological and acute stress claims as well, particularly for children where bedwetting and crying in the night, which are often normal rights of development for children are claimed to be significant stress as a result of car accidents. And soft tissue injuries, whiplash, etc., much higher proportion of those types of injuries as well. So those data analytical methodologies can then be used to get some flags that can be put into insurers' systems to be able to identify possible claims that may be possibly fraudulent, and therefore they could be dealt with differently as they're managed. And some of the flags are obviously identified by the work that was done. I guess what's interesting is those data analytics techniques are not that sophisticated, and it's given the problems have been there for quite a while, in the last few years, I guess the industry has a bit of catch-up to do in terms of data analysis to understand the fraud issue and respond to it.
How many of you noticed that John was actually speeding up in his talk as it went on? See, that's what I think is missing when you think about fraud. There is no sense of urgency. But there is some action happening thanks to CIRA, thanks to the government agency. So in the next couple of minutes, or how much have I got? Oh, 5 minutes. Okay, great. okay. So in the next couple of minutes, what I want to say to you is there's lots of action that's happening at the moment, but there is no sense of urgency. There is the start to a sense of urgency, which... For someone who's like me, an insurance veteran of 30 years plus, it's a bit of a shame because when you think back to the 80s, and I'm going to take you back on a trip halfway through my presentation to a time which when Graham was a boy, and you know I was a mere lad back then, and there was a real sense of urgency back then. There is no sense of urgency, or at least there's some seeds of that happening right now. So what's happened on the motor in the CTP space? Well, CIRA has certainly taken some action. There's a ban on referral fees from 2015. The CTP Fraud Task Force was set up earlier this year. They first of all set up a fraud hotline. They established a multi-agency task force involving police and other authorities. They encourage insurers to adopt best practice in fraud identification and prevention strategies, and they mounted a education awareness campaign. In November, or in this early part of this month, CIRA introduced a cap on legal costs which basically meant that you cannot contract out of scheduled fees for claims of $50,000 and less. And, of course, CTP scheme reform, where you know, there's likely, if it ever happens, that is, that there will be a defined benefit scheme, which will make it much harder to make claims. But I want to also talk about regulation for a minute. And I suppose we've got a bit of a state of origin theme here. It's not often that we want to say Queensland's better than New South Wales, but in this case, they are. So it has its origins in the fact that most New South Wales, if not all New South Wales government departments or agencies, whereas MACE is actually a statutory corporation. It has the ability to sue and be sued. In the case of CIRA, we're not saying that they can't, but they have the power to bring prosecution, but they actually have to conduct an independent investigation to gather sufficient admissible evidence to prove the offence. They can't actually stand in the shoes of the insurer, and that's the point we want to make. I was around when the Motor Accidents Act was enacted in 1989, and we made sure that there were some clauses in that legislation which addressed fraud. And I was just saying before that those reforms haven't really moved a lot in that time, unfortunately. But I'm glad to see that's happening right now. I want to touch on insurer culture to say, you know, this is an excerpt from a New South Wales Bar Association paper to a Law and Justice Committee hearing, and they said insurers are prepared to throw undue amounts of go-away money at claims, and it's hardly surprising that a claims culture follows. Now, I was a claims manager once, and I understand the pressure that, you know, you've got to get through those claims. You want to make sure that you hit your KPIs. But it's very important to think about what sort of perception and what stance is the insurer going to take. So let me take you on a trip back in time. So back in the day, I worked for NRMA Insurance for a very short time, about 28 years in all. It was very interesting. As I said, I was just a mere lad at the time. And we had a manager by the name of Neville King who said, we've got to create a climate of risk. Now, NRMA Insurance, with the cooperation of the other insurer that was in CTP, GIO, worked together. Amazing. There was cooperation between the two insurers, and we unearthed a string of staged accidents around Griffith and around ACT involving names such as Carboni, Barbaro, Pangallo and Reich. We ran 8 cases. We won. We didn't win them. We were never able to establish fraud, but we had 7 verdicts for the defendant. And that sent a very, very clear message. And the organisation said, we are not going to tolerate fraud. And I said to you before, what we did was make sure that when the motor accidents legislation was enacted in 1988, that fraud would actually be addressed as one of the actions which will not be tolerated. Now, insurers can join proceedings if they prove or they believe there is fraud. My understanding is that it has never been done before. But at least there was a step forward in that regard. Turning very quickly to technology, it's a double-edged sword. You know, you've got fantastic scanners and printers which can produce fake receipts. You've obviously got social media. You can track what other people are doing, and you can, I'm going into other areas than just motor accident insurance fraud. And obviously all of this is aiding and abetting fraudsters. But on the flip side, you've got data analytics. You've social media. So we know of several companies where insurers are... I'm being given the flick right now. Insurers are actually using social media to track what's happening, what's the chatter. Yeah, I think I might just go straight to the last bit. So technology, social media in particular, telematics. We have a bit of a scorecard which we want to sort of leave you with to say, well, insurers have a primary responsibility. they're doing lots of work around awareness and around increased fraud detection. We want insurers to actually take a long, hard look about insurer culture. How we, you know, should we have a zero tolerance towards fraud? Encourage cooperation, encourage data sharing as long as it's, you know, and there might be legislation required to permit that. On the regulatory side, there's been some strengthening, but I think we need sharpened regulatory teeth, as I mentioned before. Community, more concerned about awareness. Now, Raj mentioned that we believe the cost of fraud to the average CTP premium is about $75 out of about $600. So if you take it from the cost angle, maybe we'll get more action, because we certainly need to do, insurers, regulators need to do more to raise community awareness about fraud. And, of course, there's all this ongoing debate about the size of the problem. We really do need to create a sense of urgency, and I would encourage you all to take a role in that. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for that. Sounds like there's lots of things that we need to do before we can say we are actually winning. We've got a couple of minutes for questions. So if you have a question, would you please make your way to the mic stand over there and speak into the mic.
My name's Julie, and I'm from Liberty International Underwriters. We don't do CTP, but I thought your graph was interesting. What part does societal and judicial attitudes have to play in fraud? Because, you know, I recall the post-HIH World Trade Center environment, and the media was all about, you know, so-and-so is trying to steal money from this insurance company, whereas prior to that, and I think now, it's the opposite. It's more against the insurance companies. So I would have thought that had a role to play as well.
I'll let on. You're absolutely right. I think we've got to change the mindset. We've got to show that fraud is a cost to the community. It's not a victimless crime. Now, there's a lot of, you know, you're competing. There's competing in lots of other things. Now, the police will say, well, hang on, there's crimes against the person. You know, and of course, terrorism. So it's taking the oxygen out of that sort of debate and the sort of resourcing. But you're absolutely right. How do we create that sense of urgency that fraud is a problem? It must be tackled, and it must be tackled seriously.
Look, I'd agree with that. I think also the insurance industry has to deal with a lot of reputational issues, and sometimes it's seen as fair game to perpetrate fraud on insurers. I think if you did a ranking of community attitudes about where insurance sits, it's probably somewhere between banks and used car dealers. So, we've got to obviously undertake a lot of steps to try and fight that on numerous fronts. But I think it's going to happen not just by insurers. I think it's got to be multifaceted through, you know, social media, insurers, regulators, government, and the police. I think it's got to be a combined approach to really deal with the issue. In the UK, they had to deal with this, you know, they've had to deal with this for a long time. Insurers are seen as a bit of as fair game, essentially.
Unfortunately, we've run out of time, so would you please join me in thanking our three speakers.